Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
You are. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last week, a federal appeals court in Richmond, Virginia, ruled that a wartime president can detain a U.S. citizen captured as an enemy combatant and deny that person access to legal representation. For some, the decision is just the latest in a series of sharp infringements on American civil liberties. To others, it's common sense. Tonight on Point, we look at the scorecard of liberties lost in the name of security in the open-ended war on terror and ask if we have the right balance. We begin with Neil Lewis, Washington reporter for The New York Times, who has been covering the case of U.S. citizen and accused enemy combatant Yasser Hamdi. I asked him to describe the sweep of executive leeway that the federal appeals court gave the president with its ruling.
I believe it's quite a major legal victory for the administration, which is facing challenges on several legal fronts about its policies to fight terrorism. There are a whole bunch of cases that are making their way up through the courts, having to do with immigration detention hearings, what to do with these enemy combatants. And so far, I would say this is the most sweeping victory the administration has obtained yet, because the three-judge panel that sits in Richmond ruled that the Bush administration was within its rights to detain Yasser Hamdi as an enemy combatant, and the courts had a very reduced role in examining the cause for that detention, namely the government's designation of him as an enemy combatant.
So the court said, we're not going to really go in and investigate whether or not that's true. We're going to rely on the government's characterization of him as an enemy combatant.
That's precisely so. The government had submitted a 9-paragraph affidavit from an official in the Pentagon saying that Mr. Hamdi, the 22-year-old prisoner who was a Saudi national but a United States citizen, that he was captured on the battlefield in Afghanistan with a weapon. Now, he's being held incommunicado at a naval brig in Norfolk, Virginia, and it's unclear whether he challenges that or doesn't. His lawyers, who have never spoken with him, say he has a right to challenge that. But essentially, the court said this is not a business for judges, that war and the decisions of war are best left to the other two branches. We should not delve too deeply into this.
So first of all, then, the court accepted the Bush administration's characterization of what was going on here as war. Was there any question about that? Did the attorneys for Hamdi seek to question that?
They sought to question one factor of it. No, they didn't dispute that we had been at war, but they questioned whether the president, especially in this unusual situation with regards to the war on terrorism, whether the president or the military can say the war continues, because the so-called hot war in Afghanistan is largely over. Mm-hmm. So the lawyers for Mr. Hamdi appealed to the judges to intervene and say, you know, we're not at war anymore. But again, the judges ruled in favor of the administration, saying, no, this is a decision left to the president and his military advisors. We, sitting here in our robes in a courtroom, may not decide when a war is over.
Now, the judges did say that even as an enemy combatant citizen, they could not deny Mr. Hamdi the writ of habeas corpus.
That's right. And there are different ways to interpret why and how the court found that. Habeas corpus, a venerable way to challenge detentions, to go to court and force judicial authorities to go to the executive authority and say, why are you holding this person? Mm-hmm. You have to justify it. Mm-hmm. A writ that goes back to Old England is held in such high regard that had the judges said, well, he doesn't even have that, even though he's a citizen, this would have made the opinion more controversial and would have increased the chances that it would be taken up by the Supreme Court. As it stands now, the Supreme Court is not obliged to revisit this case. They can just let this decision stand. Now, again, they said he's a perfect candidate for habeas corpus because he's a U.S. citizen and he's detained by the government. So he has habeas corpus. But in the end, the inquiry that we as a court make under his request for a writ of habeas corpus is a very minimal one. So it said the principle exists, but doesn't provide much help for Mr. Hamdi.
In other words, they're not going to dig deeply into this, even though the principle stands for him.
That's precisely so. That phrase you used, not going to dig into it too deeply, is parallels what the judges said several times, the three-judge panel of the appeals court.
Essentially, the judges said that the conduct of war should not be determined by litigation. That is, it's up to the executive. The president has a pretty free hand here. The courts, we think, should, will stay out of it.
That is certainly a fair summary. They said that especially that litigation should not determine the course of a war, because if Mr. Hamdi were allowed to conduct a full-blown inquiry into his status, how he was captured, things like that, that would require the government to bring back from the theater of war halfway across the globe military commanders to answer questions from his lawyers. And there the court was pointed in saying, you know, we can't have that while we're at war. We can't have military commanders summoned out of the field. Litigation should not determine the course of the war, the conduct of the war.
At some level, that sounds reasonable, Neil Lewis. What's been the response to the appellate court's ruling publicly? Has it sparked controversy? Is there pushback?
Well, when you ask about the public response, I mean, I strongly believe it divides among people who have somewhat settled opinions about these kind of things. In the case of people who follow it closely, mm-hmm. let's say the academic community, there is, in fact, in this case, a pair of briefs, one from many dozens of law professors opposing the government's position, saying this could lead to terrible circumstances and gives the government extraordinary and unnecessary powers. Mm. There's a second brief on the other side supporting the government from a much smaller group of law professors.
What's the main danger that critics see in this ruling?
That given the standards of this case, they claim, and let me emphasize it's their claim, that this means the government can seize anybody on a foreign battlefield and hold them indefinitely without recourse to a lawyer, without recourse to bail, and without recourse to the courts to challenge the reason for it, which is the designation as an enemy combatant.
And when you say anybody, you mean including U.S. citizens?
This is specifically about U.S. citizens, because Mr. Hamdi is indeed a U.S. citizen. There's only at the moment one other case that's similar, the case of Jose Padilla, the so-called dirty bomber. Mm-hmm. And an important distinction there is that Mr. Padilla, who's charged with trying to get intelligence to build a radioactive device that could be set off in America, he was arrested on U.S. soil. As this Padilla case has proceeded in federal court in New York, government lawyers have cited this opinion from the Richmond Federal Appeals Court in support of their efforts to keep Mr. Padilla from a lawyer.
In that case, an American citizen arrested even in the United States, if they followed that line of reasoning, it could be argued, would be an enemy combatant if they were aligned with forces of terrorism.
Well, that is indeed the case of Mr. Padilla, who was arrested in the United States. He's an American citizen, and he's been deemed an enemy combatant.
Neil Lewis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Neil Lewis is Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke with us earlier today from Washington. Yasser Hamdi, a 22-year-old American-born Saudi national, was captured on a battlefield allegedly fighting for the Taliban in November 2001. He now sits in a military jail in Virginia. Last week's federal appeals court decision on Hamdi handed the Bush administration a major legal victory by ruling that the courts must defer to a president with respect to military judgments during wartime, even when the defendant is a U.S. citizen. Courts have traditionally taken a backseat to the Oval Office during war in the interest of allowing the president maximum flexibility to focus on victory. But the Hamdi ruling is only the latest sign that Osama bin Laden has succeeded in forcing Americans to rethink the concept that defines this country, civil liberty, the foundation of freedom. Government secrecy, due process, citizen privacy, checks and balances. Since 9/11, reality has changed on all these fronts. Critics say bedrock civil liberties are being eroded. Some say that's the price of survival. What do you think? Do Americans stand on a shrinking island of civil liberties? Are you ready to surrender some of your liberties in the interest of security? Do you need to? And at what point do we lose the freedom we're fighting for. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Elissa Massimino, Washington Director of Lawyers, the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights. I'm sorry I massacred that, but good evening and welcome, Elissa Massimino.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thanks so much for being with us. Elissa, your group has come out with an in-depth report called A Year of Loss about what you describe as erosions of civil liberties, of fundamental liberties in the United States since the attacks of September 11th. At this point, it's even a few months further on down the road since your report first came out, and we continue to see cases coming through the courts. Your executive director, Michael Posner, writes that since September 11th, the United States has lost something essential, something defining. What is that?
Well, I think one way to describe it is the kind of checks and balances that people, kind of the basic civics lessons that you learn in junior high are almost not true anymore. The idea that you have a vibrant court system that acts as a check on executive power, the idea that you have an active Congress that's independent of the executive branch, that you have a vibrant willingness to dissent on the part of the on a part of the public and on the part of particular members of the three branches, I think that's something really that we are losing. And this most recent court victory in the Fourth Circuit for the administration is quite significant, a marker in that decline in civil liberties.
Elissa Massimino, your report says what is at stake is nothing less than the fundamental nature of U.S. society and whether we will retain what James Madison called the blessings of liberty. I wish you'd give us a kind of checklist of where you see the erosion here. The report says that these changes have taken place so slowly, incrementally, kind of beneath the surface. But if you look there, it says the very bones of U.S. law, policy, and practice have shifted. Take us down that junior high civics lesson checklist, if you will, and put some meat on the bones of what you're saying we've lost. In the first instance, checks and balances.
Well, what we've seen almost immediately after September 11th was a Congress willing to acquiesce in almost every demand for new executive power that it heard. We saw passage of the USA Patriot Act in late October 2001 at a time when Congress was under threat from anthrax and many congressional offices were closed. At the time the House was voting on USA Patriot, there were literally two hard copies of the bill on the floor of the House. And Congress was under enormous pressure.
So no real debate, no real consideration in your view?
Very little debate.
Open government is another point that you make here. You say our tradition of sunshine, of open government, of decisions made in the public square is being eroded. How?
The Attorney General, shortly after September 11th, issued a new directive to Justice Department employees, effectively flipping the presumption of the Freedom of Information Act, which is the very important government sunshine legislation that allows the public to gain information about government decision-making and the facts on which the government is making policy. And the Attorney General announced that his Justice Department would support every refusal to produce documents requested by the public under the Freedom of Information Act.
John,
and in fact, that's borne true for us. We've asked for numerous items of information from the government relating to their decisions on everything from enemy combatants to immigration changes in immigration policy, and all have been denied on the grounds of national security.
So the government bars the door, and quickly before we come to the break, citizen privacy.
Well, there have been vast changes in the government's power to insert itself into the private lives of all citizens. This is perhaps the area where most people are going to be affected. You have now the power by the government to look at library records, and librarians all over the country rising up in great concern about the fact that library records are no longer private.
And that's just one example, getting down to that level of detail. We're talking tonight about the health of American civil liberties in the open-ended war on terror. Have American civil liberties, in your view, been diminished since 9/11? Are you ready to surrender liberties in the interest of security, or is the bedrock of freedom at risk here? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the health of American civil liberties in the open-ended war on terror. We're taking stock. Join us. Does bin Laden win by knocking down towers or by knocking down liberties? And has the Bush administration exercised restraint or been too ready to compromise American civil liberties? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is Elissa Massimino. She's Washington Director of the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights. And we're joined now a couple of other gentlemen. John Hudson joins us from Concord, New Hampshire. He's dean of the Franklin Pierce Law Center and a former judge advocate general in the U.S. Navy. Good evening and welcome, John Hudson.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And from Chicago joining us tonight, Jeffrey Stone, professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School and former dean and provost of the law school. He's currently working on a book on free speech in wartime. Good evening and welcome, Jeffrey Stone.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us. John Hudson, let me turn to you first. You've heard Elissa Massimino's summary of where she and the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights see the progress of American civil liberties in the months since 9/11/2001. In their view, this is not a pretty picture. Fundamental rights are being eroded. And though she didn't have time to say so yet, I know that the group concludes that they say many of the extraordinary measures taken over the last year plus now now require repeal or substantial adjustments and refinements. What's your view, John Hudson? We took a big blow on 9/11. How have we responded? Has it been a reasonable response? Has it been a response that threatens the fundament of American liberties?
Well, I think it is extraordinary. These are, in many respects, extraordinary times, and but I don't think that it undermines our fundamental freedoms and liberties. You know, we limit our own civil liberties all the time. You know, speed limits, and there are all kinds of rules that limit what it is we do. And there's a certain ebb and flow through time. If you take the long-range view of that, there's a certain ebb and flow through time of the status of each of those liberties. Since 9/11, to be sure, we have intruded on some of those liberties. I'm not sure that's an altogether bad thing. You know, the question of Freedom of Information Act. Freedom of Information Act was passed in response to certain abuses that took place in the 1970s. And for 28 years in the Navy, it was, for me, it was a big pain. You know, we dealt with it, but limiting that, putting our arms around that, putting that in, and we certainly need it. I'm not arguing against the Freedom of Information Act by any stretch of the imagination, but we need to be able to deal with it in a rational sort of way. And I think that what's happened in the Hamdi case and what's happened in many other situations with regard to immigrants and illegal aliens and so forth is not an example of the sky falling.
John Hudson, let's cut right to the heart of this. I mean, we hear you as a former Navy JAG saying that the Freedom of Information Act is a big pain. And, you know, perhaps civil libertarians might say, well, it's supposed to be, and that's your cross to bear if you want to be in the U.S. military.
That's right.
On the other hand, the country was attacked on September 11th,
right.
And there is a possibility of more attacks. You're saying, I have nothing against it, it's important, but you sound happy to limit it. Take that to a larger frame. Take it to a larger frame for us, John. Are you saying that, yes, we now have to limit our civil liberties? You talk about an ebb and flow. Is this
yes.
a time when, in your view, an ebb is appropriate?
I think it is. And I would disagree with the characterization of happy. I think in a perfect world, we wouldn't have to do this. But it is an imperfect world. And I think most people, if they don't at least expect another terrorist attack here, they're certainly afraid of it. I'm not too concerned about, at least where we are right now. You could push it a little bit further and, you know, let it ebb more, and you're even going to get me to object to it. But where we are right now, I don't think is a cause of great concern. And indeed, we may be much better off where we are now than we would than we were before.
Jeffrey Stone, if you'll stand by for just a moment, I want to get Elissa Massimino's response to John Hudson's observations.
Yeah. Well, I think we have to be really careful here. We're in a situation in which 10 administration officials have admitted to a reporter the use of torture and interrogation of captives in the war on terrorism. We're in a situation where a U.S. citizen is held in a military installation without access to counsel, and virtually without the right to habeas corpus. People who are willing to acquiesce in the suspension of rights in emergencies, in wartime, until the enemy is defeated and we can get back to normal, we have to be careful. The president has determined that the enemy is global, the whole world's the battlefield, and the war will continue until international terrorism is defeated. I mean, this is the new normal. So we really have to ask ourselves, you know, what kind of democracy do we want? Do we want the kind that the framers envisioned, where you have checks and balances? Or do you want the kind where U.S. citizens can be put in jail indefinitely without access to counsel on the say-so of the commander-in-chief? That I think that's really the question that we're facing here. And I agree that that, you know, we have to be careful and the balance may shift between liberty and security. But we also can't fail to recognize significant turning points in our democracy. Mm-hmm. And I really think that if we're not there yet, we certainly are fast approaching one where we will be making decisions that fundamentally affect the nature of our democracy.
There's no question the stakes are very large here. Jeffrey Stone, I want to bring you in. We're taking stock tonight of what we've held on to and what we've lost since 9/11 on the civil liberties front. If you'd be good enough, give us an historical perspective here. If this is war, how do the limitations on liberties that have emerged compare with those that have emerged in other American war times?
A historical perspective should teach us that we have a long history in wartime of overreacting to our concerns at the expense of civil liberties, particularly civil liberties of people who might be defined as the other, who aren't the ones who are making the rules. In the Civil War, Lincoln, as we all know, suspended the writ of habeas corpus on 8 occasions. The Supreme Court later held that Lincoln, in fact, abused that authority and that some of those suspensions were unconstitutional. Some 38,000 people were imprisoned under those suspensions by military authorities in the North without any judicial review or any opportunity to test the legality of their detentions. During World War I, during a period of some considerable hysteria about possible disloyalty within the country, the United States passed the Sedition Act, which made it a crime for any person to make any statement that would bring the government or the president or the military forces into disrepute. And under the World War I law, some 2,000 individuals were arrested and charged with violations of those statutes. The Supreme Court later held that all of those convictions were a violation of the First Amendment to the Constitution. During World War II, we know that after Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt approved the internment of 120,000 Japanese Americans. 90% of all Japanese Americans, that is, American citizens of Japanese descent, were interned for 3 years in concentration camps in the United States. All of those are examples of situations where, with hindsight, it's perfectly clear that there were serious abuses, all of which were thought to be reasonable by the people who were implementing them at the time. So the lesson of that is that there's a necessity to try to step back from ourselves when we're in the midst of these crises, because it's much easier to judge them in hindsight than it is to judge them when you are in the middle of one, and to avoid or to attempt to avoid making the same kinds of mistakes that we've made in the past.
And yet, Jeffrey Stone, in each of those wars, Americans felt deeply threatened. If the Supreme Court found after the fact that the Constitution had been violated, it was also after victory. This time, the country is told by security experts, we hear it on this show, that terror threats can be absolutely devastating. Is there any reasonable point at which civil liberties should be crimped in the interest of national survival. In your view, do our current circumstances constitute that kind of moment?
I think it's all a matter of degree. It's certainly the case that what we in peacetime regard as our civil liberties can, to some degree, be constricted in the face of crises or emergency circumstances. I don't think there's any serious doubt about that question. The issue is in what circumstances and to what degree. In the present circumstances, I have no doubt that there are sufficient threats to national security and to individual security in the nation that the government can take some measures that would not otherwise be deemed permissible. On the other hand, I agree with Alyssa Massimino that in significant respects, the government has gone further than it should have gone in these circumstances. And what concerned me most is some of the intrusions on privacy and the detentions and deportations of over 1,000 aliens. And overlaying all of that is the extreme secrecy, which I think is in so many ways most troubling, because the government, by refusing to disclose critical information, has in many respects paralyzed the public in terms of their ability to evaluate its own actions.
Alyssa Massimino, if you'd be good enough, take us to the specific points where you think the U.S. went too far in response to 9/11 and ought to now step back. Where are you most concerned? Where would you most like to see a repeal, a reverse?
Well, first I want to say I completely agree with Professor Stone that there are necessary adjustments in civil liberties that have to come in a time of threat like this, whether you call it war or not. And it is a question of which liberties and how much threat. And the reason why I think we've gone so wrong in so many areas, including the new power to indefinitely detain non-citizens who the Attorney General has a suspicion may be involved in terrorism. That's one that came with USA Patriot that I think absolutely should be repealed. And the new infringements on privacy in terms of the internet and the ability to look at the at the websites that people that people surf and the library books that you check out, is that we have had a complete lack of debate on the question of, will this measure make us safer? There is this rush to do everything, anything, all these old proposals being pulled out of the drawer that would never have passed before and now are being passed willy-nilly, adopted by executive fiat in many cases, where we have absolutely no debate about whether or not it will make us safer. And that's what you need to have if you're going to try to have a real balance of security and liberty.
John Hudson, let me turn to you for a minute. We've got it. John Hudson, what's your view? Have we rushed willy-nilly into these steps, and have infringements on civil liberties, which we can see as such, made the country safer? Are they necessary to a certain level of security, or are they not?
Yes, no, and yes. We have rushed. It hasn't been willy-nilly, and it has made us safer, I think. Listen, we've indicted Congress, the executive branch, and the court system so far. Maybe they're not all wrong. And indeed, we're having a debate right here. I mean, there is conversation about this. The fact that the conversation tends in recent years, the last 18 months or so, to infringe on liberties doesn't necessarily make that wrong. You know, Professor Wedgwood talks about Al-Qaeda's gargantuan appetite for violence and revenge. The New York Times yesterday reported that there are concerns about troop transport planes being targeted. As I said, people are afraid. And
John Hudson, if this is an open-ended war, is it your view that Americans have to make a kind of permanent compromise, then, of traditional civil liberties?
Well, open-ended and permanent aren't necessarily the same. I think that while this war against terrorism is going on, and none of us know how long it's going to be, and we all hope that it's not going to be permanent, but as long as it's going on, I think people are going to have to make some sacrifices. If we've rounded up, as Professor Stone states, 1,000 or so illegal aliens and deported them. The INS is awaking from a long slumber. I'm not sure that's all bad.
We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. We're talking tonight about the health of American civil liberties in an open-ended war on terror. Dave's calling from Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. Great. Great show. Thanks for taking my call. I want to remind everybody that there's a war on drugs that is going on that, you know, we said back then when a lot of our liberties were taken away then, you know, it'll only be a little while. But that's going on. That's never going to end. And I don't see why anybody would think that a war on terror would ever end or why we'd even talk about that, because that's never going to happen. A war on terror is always going to go on. Our rights are probably never going to come back until we get, you know, a different regime in our White House. And I think that if the FBI and CIA and the INS would have been doing all the stuff they should have been doing, they shouldn't have to come on my email. They shouldn't have to look and see who I'm chatting with. They shouldn't have to be able to listen to my phone conversations. There's no reason for that if they'd have been doing their job to begin with.
So you don't see the threat as large enough, as keen enough to surrender civil liberties?
I think that if we had a government that was actually doing what they should have been doing, they shouldn't have to take away my liberties.
Dave, thanks for your call. Jeffrey Stone, I want to get to this issue of the characterization of the state of the nation now as a nation at war. In legal terms, does that stand up?
Not in the most literal sense, since Congress has the power to declare war and Congress has not declared war. On the other hand, we've only declared war a very few times in our history, and yet we fought in hundreds of engagements that we have essentially treated as if it was war. So I think the plain and simple fact is that the characterization of war or not in terms of a constitutional declaration of war is not essential. As far back as the Barbary Pirates, the United States had to deal with something the equivalent of terrorism, which was not really a nation state, and we treated it as a war even though there was no one against whom to declare war. And that's very similar to the situation we have now. So
when the definition
I would say
vague,
that we are.
When the definition is vague, at least, however, how do we know when it's over? How do we feel some assurance that if there are compromises made, they're temporary?
Well, I don't think we have any assurance of that, and I think the analogy to the war on drugs is correct. I think from day one, President Bush made clear that this was going to be a long haul and that it wasn't clear when we would know that it was over. And that very statement, I think, should give rise to the kind of caution that the caller suggested. If we don't have a conventional war where we can be reasonably confident that there will be a definable end, then we should be especially cautious about making changes with respect to our freedoms without having very rigorous, for example, sunset provisions that require reenactment after a period of a year or 2 years. The danger is that we slip into a state of just being used to not having the liberties, and then no one ever revisits the question.
There's the danger. We're taking stock tonight of American civil liberties in an open-ended war on terror. Are you ready to surrender liberties in the interest of security, or is the bedrock of freedom at risk here? Have Congress and the courts been too deferential to the executive branch, or do you want the commander-in-chief to have a strong, free hand in the war on terror? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about the health of American civil liberties in an open-ended war on terror. We're taking stock. Join us. Is it time to roll back the Patriot Act, to reconsider national compromises made on civil liberties after 9/11? Or is this what it takes to survive? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. My guests tonight are Elissa Massimino, Washington Director of the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, Jeffrey Stone, Professor of Law at the University of Chicago, currently writing a book on free speech in wartime, and John Hudson, Dean of the Franklin Pierce Law Center, a former Judge Advocate General in the U.S. Navy. You can join us as well. Dennis is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Dennis. You're on the air. Dennis, are you there?
Hi, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear. What's on your mind?
Okay. Well, I'd like to preface this by saying that I did not vote for George Bush, and I think John Ashcroft is an embarrassment to the position of Attorney General.
You're entitled to your opinion.
Okay. However, I think that the reality that we as Americans have to face is that we have lived blissfully while the world struggled around us, and Osama bin Laden has brought that struggle to American soil, and he's not going away. They use, whether bin Laden disappears or not, these people will use our fundamental freedoms against us. And our society has to change if we're going to survive. I travel a lot. I was very frightened traveling on airport on airlines before 9/11 because I felt security was a joke. Mm-hmm. I'm much more comfortable traveling now, and I'm very happy to go through the intrusive inspections as I go onto the airline to know that perhaps they'll catch the next Richard Reed. And I think that's the reality that we have to face. And if it means that people might check on our library records or what books we take out, that's a small sacrifice to make to survive.
Alyssa Massimino, please respond to Dennis. He's on the line.
Well, absolutely. You know, Dennis, you're absolutely right that the U.S. has lived blissfully without the kind of violence that so many other societies have faced from terrorism. My organization works on human rights in a lot of those countries as well. And one of the things that we take away from that experience is the way in which so-called emergency measures in Egypt, say, where there's been 20 years of emergency rule, or in Turkey, where there had been a serious domestic terrorist threat, has so fundamentally corrupted the criminal justice system that it's difficult to see it ever being built back up. That's a lesson that I take away from that. One of the things I wanted to ask Dean Hudson is, as the daughter of a naval submarine commander myself, I think one thing that we're gonna agree on is that we have a premier military justice system. And that's an area that I see our so-called war on terrorism and the steps being taken by the administration potentially degrading. We have the gem of the world in terms of a military justice system, and much of that is being tossed aside in the cases like the Hamdi case and in the treatment of the Guantanamo prisoners. In past wars, we had lots and lots of proceedings where we determined whether somebody was really an enemy combatant or was an innocent bystander or in the wrong place at the wrong time. And now, all of a sudden, even when such a person is a U.S. citizen, we can't even afford that minimal due process that the military commissions
has traditionally had. John Hudson, how about it? We've addressed Dennis's concern a bit here, but what's your view? Are we seeing a kind of a rollback of liberties not only in the civil side but in the military side as well?
Well, I certainly wholeheartedly agree with the proposition that we have the eminent military justice system in the world, and I'm very proud of that, as all Americans should be. I have evolved in my thinking about this. When the president first offered tribunals up as military commissions, so to speak, as the avenue for dealing with detainees, I completely agreed with Alyssa that we ought to be doing this instead in courts martial. Mm. My thinking has evolved and changed, though, the more reading I've done, the more thinking I've done about it.
Why?
Because courts martial are there to deal with criminal offenses. And as of 9/11, the terrorists graduated from mere criminal activity to war. And courts martial, or the U.S. district courts for that matter, aren't really equipped to deal with those kinds of scenarios. And since the Revolutionary War, those have been handled by military tribunals, and I think that's the appropriate forum for the detainees that are presently in Cuba and others that may come, if they're going to be pursued as war criminals and not just released at the end of the hostilities.
And John Hudson, what about Alyssa Massimino's larger point, that her organization around the world sees Many countries take extraordinary steps in times of turmoil that are never rolled back and ultimately are not effective either. So you lose your liberties and you don't solve the security problem.
Well, that goes back to a point that Professor Stone made, too. It kind of reminds me that about what happened in the Civil War with the suspension of habeas corpus and the Sedition Act and the terrible Japanese internments. I have more faith in the American system than that. And I think that if and when the time comes that the war on terrorism isn't a concern, or it is at least a reduced concern, we will reevaluate, as we have now, what it is we're doing. And I think that our system is better than that in Egypt, for example, and that we will be able to address those things as they did after the Civil War and after World War I and after World War II.
Jeffrey Stone, are you equally confident in that ebb and flow, that what ebbs today will flow tomorrow, that liberties lost today come back tomorrow?
Our experience, in fact, has been consistent with what Dean Hudson suggests. The only thing that distinguishes this situation is the ambiguity about what an end is. But it is the case that one of the concerns that's often raised about the suppression of civil liberties in wartime is that if you lose civil liberties once, you lose them forever. In fact, that has not been our experience. Our experience has been that, rightly or wrongly, what we do in wartime, once the war is over, tends to be reexamined, and we go back to a baseline, often even a better baseline. So my deeper concern is less with the long run, although I do think the absence of a clear end is a serious concern, than it is with the fact that during the wartime, we can do many things to harm a great many people that are unjustified, and that in itself is a serious concern that we should take very seriously. And just to say that, well, someday down the road we'll be able to look back and we'll readjust things to make them right again, doesn't mean that it was okay to intern 120,000 Japanese Americans because we later gave them reparations. The point was we should have known better than to do it in the first place. And we didn't take the steps at that time to prevent ourselves from doing it.
Elissa Massimino, given the world circumstances that we're facing, do you trust in that pendulum, that it swings one way in the last year and a half, it will swing the other way one day?
Well, I'm afraid I don't have as much confidence that it's going to swing back, and that's just as we started the program talking about the fundamental changes to the structure of the democracy. I mean, this is not just Egypt I'm talking about, but look at the UK and Northern Ireland. Emergency measures that were put in place in Northern Ireland, many of them never repealed and now apply UK-wide. So, I mean, we're talking about old democracies here as well and not just Egypt and Turkey.
And your group has made the point that in a globalized era, what we do in the United States tends to bleed out globally, tends to be copied around the world. Does it change the entire baseline for viewing liberty?
Well, it certainly makes my job a whole lot harder as I go out and try to talk to officials of other governments about their human rights records. I get thrown back in my face the fact that the U.S. is holding its own citizens, and then frequently the citizens of the government I'm talking to, in incommunicado detention without access to counsel. And now we are horrified to learn that the U.S. may actually be engaging in or acquiescing in the torture of some of those detainees. That is, I think, a bridge too far here, and it's a wake-up call for us. This is not what the United States is about in wartime or in peacetime.
And when you go abroad, you're hearing, if you can do it, we can do it too. Teresa's calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Hi, Teresa. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to say that I think that the focus of the discussion should take a look at fear, because I think that the idea of security is, in fact, an illusion, and that our war on terrorism isn't really going to bring any security in the future, that security as an idea, the way the Bush administration is putting it forth, is playing on our fears. And as long as we're acting out of fear, we're going to be making more problems and not less problems.
Teresa, I want to be sure I understand what you mean. I mean, security at some level is surely a real thing. A chemical plant blows up or it doesn't blow up, and there's a difference.
Right, but in terms of we're going at this war on terrorism, and you know we're going to be able to make there be less terrorism in the future. I mean, I don't think that the way that we're looking at it, making ourselves more afraid and making, you know, an earlier caller, I think three callers ago, said something about these people bring this to us. I mean, that whole these people, us, them, is what is going to, you know, propagate liberties to be taken away from us because they're, you know, doing something to us. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes. I think I do, though we can see around the country and in our security posture, the us, them is very sharply and clearly defined. Elissa Massimino, I think I've got to give this one back to you because your whole report seems to suggest that ultimately we draw more security from holding fast to civil liberties than in building a big security apparatus. It sounds like Teresa would agree with that, but I'm sure many people want to see a substantial security apparatus against the kind of threat we saw on September 11th. What's the interaction between these things?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I would disagree a bit with the caller in that, you know, there is absolutely no question that the U.S. Is, you know, suffered a terrible attack by people who continue to wish us harm and are plotting to kill more Americans and others inside the United States and abroad. And we have to be willing to act to stop that. But where I think I agree with the tenor of some of her comments are that we do have to look to the broader, the root causes of terrorism. And I think that the Bush administration is very much waking up to that. And in fact has started to talk about the importance of promoting democracy in the Middle East, for example, although its efforts in that regard are not always as strong as we'd like them to be. There is a clear recognition, I think, that democratic societies, societies in which there is a free press and freedom to associate and civic society, and the right to freely elect leaders, those societies are much less likely to produce terrorists.
So there's a value in upholding that there and here.
So that has to be part of our security strategy. It has to be. And so too much focus on, you know, building walls, sweeping up foreigners, deporting foreigners, holding people incommunicado, breaking the laws of war is not going to be a full solution, a long-term solution. In fact,
I want to get one more call, if you'll allow me.
Absolutely.
Mike is on the line. Welcome, Mike. You're on the air.
Thank you. In 1776, a single individual could only kill one person at a time. Today, a single individual could kill millions with a nuclear weapon. I think it's unreasonable to expect we have the same civil liberties today as we had in 1776. People are more lethal now. And we have to adjust to that.
So you're saying the nation, the ideal of the founders, does not apply today. Jeffrey Stone, pick that up, please.
Well, it's obviously an accurate point, and it does mean that the measures one needs to take to prevent that from happening have to be more carefully focused. But I would like to go back to the prior caller, if I can, who talked about fear, I think, very insightfully. Two phrases Justice Brandeis once used I would like to see plastered all over billboards around this country. One is that fear breeds repression, and the other is that courage is the secret of liberty. And those two phrases, I think, are fundamental in understanding how one has to cope with the type of crisis that we have at present.
But at the same time, I don't want to let Mike's thought go. When one man can carry a bomb that blows up a city, does that change the calculus permanently somehow?
It certainly changes the calculus. But the question is, what do you do in response to that? One might say, for instance, that all persons driving cars have to be searched constantly to make sure there's not a bomb in the trunk. And you can turn a society very quickly into a police state because of what fundamentally is a very remote harm.
That's where we don't want to go. Jeffrey Stone, I'm afraid we're out of time. It's been a great conversation. I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jeffrey Stone is professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School, former dean and provost there. He's coming out soon with a book on free speech in wartime. And John Hudson, joining us from Concord, New Hampshire, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you. My pleasure.
John Hudson is dean of the Franklin Pierce Law Center. And in Washington, D.C., Elissa Massimino, thank you very much for your observations tonight.
My pleasure.
Elissa Massimino is Washington director of the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.